Good evening. My name is Dan Perkins, and I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella on Recalculating, a program dedicated to helping small business leaders increase their profits. We draw the name of our show from a best-selling book which features contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all of whom want to help you grow your small business. Don?
Small businesses and Americans in general have been talking about Obamacare for the past 8 years. Now they're talking about it even more as the Republican Congress has introduced the new legislation. You know, I feel it must be good because both sides, pro and anti, dislike it. So it must be good. And we have a guest today that you should, I'm going to let you introduce because he's here to help us.
Well, thank you. Good morning, or good evening, Paul. I believe your last name, is your last name pronounced Ketchett?
It's Ketchell.
Ketchell. Okay. Paul has a very interesting business and a very interesting individual. He founded a corporate business called MD Save, and he has a lot of thoughts on a repeal of Obamacare. So, Paul, welcome to our program. Let's start off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself. Then we'll talk about your company and what you do.
Yeah, so I started out my career years ago in Washington, D.C. I worked in health policy. I started working for former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and on health care issues, primarily in the U.S. Senate and the government. And then later on, went on to be a federal health care lobbyist for 4 years and then founded a series of health care companies since then and have just sort of use that experience to try to capitalize on the issues that we see in the market and to move, move market forces forward in healthcare.
You know, Paul, I have to ask you this question as an entrepreneur, somebody who came up with an idea and started a business. With your Washington connections, is it very frustrating to try and deal with Washington?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mess in Washington. You know, what you see on TV is pretty accurate. There's a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot of conflicting interest. And, you know, really when you're up there, there's just the numbers are so big and the advantages that some people have are so large that it's really hard to get innovation moving and things happening quickly. But, you know, I do think we're starting to see some change, and it can be frustrating. But, you know, I tell people as an entrepreneur, it's frustrating and rewarding because it could take a really long time to get things done. But when you do get something done, the rewards are really big.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about what's going on in Washington today. For 8 years, since the Congress, primarily the Democratic Congress, passed Obamacare, the Republicans have been sending repeal bills up through the Senate, and unfortunately, none of them never got to the White House. But for 8 years, the Republicans have been talking about repeal and replace. When they get the chance to repeal and replace, they can't figure out what the hell they want to do. So was the repeal and replace all the things that they did for the 8 years that Obama was president was all a political ploy and they really didn't have any idea?
No, I don't think that's the issue. I think it's a little more – it's not as cut and dry as that, as you know, it should be. You know, you got to go back in history, and it's probably a longer conversation, but when you look at how the Obamacare bill was initially passed, it was passed – you remember through a process called reconciliation, which means a suspension of Senate rules. And Harry
right.
Reid didn't have enough Democrat votes to pass it, so he suspended the rules. Well, reconciliation is a process attached to budgetary bills. And so
mm-hmm.
now part of the ACA has been passed in what is known as a reconciliation process. And those parts of the bill would need to be repealed and replaced in reconciliation process. There are other parts of the law over 8 years that got passed in standard legislation, and those pieces will have to be passed and repealed in standard legislation. And then you also had sort of an outside force, which is you had some court interpretations along the way too, which may arise as new challenges or could be replaced. So I think there's been a framework to replace it. I don't think the Republican Party did a very good job of messaging messaging what that framework has been and messaging that process. But, you know, I think, you know, what you're seeing in this first bill is, you know, this first bill was 96 pages, the one that we've all been talking about this week. It's a framework to start this process. It's going to make a couple large changes quickly. But then this is going to be an ongoing process of legislation coming to update, replace, and repeal parts of that legislation. And you know, it's not as simple as we can write one bill and pass one bill, because this bill did not come to life in that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I understand, but I guess the question I want to ask is, and I don't want to put you too much on the spot, but at least to try and gain some insight, was the representation that the Republicans, when they were running in 2016, when they said repeal and then replace, was that misleading to the American electorate?
Well, I think you could say it could be potentially misleading, but I think that, you know, a repeal and replace is probably what you're going to see. You know, even though there's a lot of fighting this week up there, I just think the process isn't as fast as anyone expected. Now, I would say this, if we were to go back in time in that 8-year period you talked about, when those bills were being set up in that 8-year period, it would have been easier to replace those provisions in that time frame and before a lot of these programs went into place. So, you know, unfortunately, it's a difficult process. So I don't know if it's misleading, but I do think that the idea that you can flick a switch on and off, I think, is maybe a little bit misleading.
Was that naivete on the part of Trump and his advisors not helping to walk away from that? That was simply as repeal and replace?
Well, I think, you know, a few things happened. I think that when Trump got into office, they realized that, you know, this was a bigger problem than many had anticipated. By a bigger problem, I mean the number of people whose insurance plans could be at risk, the amount of debt that Obamacare had run up. I mean, it's blown through all budget estimates that it was supposed to. And really, the financial footing was much worse in January than anyone had realized when they took office. So there's a lot of moving pieces on here. So some of it's, I think, probably part of it is that Trump thought it was easier than it was going to be. The second thing is, I don't think he was getting a clear picture of the full size of the problem until he was sworn into office.
So what do you think is the likely outcome by the time it makes it to the president's desk?
Well, I think they're going to get a passage, and I think they're going to get a repeal and a replace. You know, on that, those initial provisions, I mean, I think, you know, there's some good things that are in the original Obamacare bill. And frankly, the good things that are in the bill are the hardest things to keep because they're costly and they're expensive, and you got to find ways to pay for those. There's other things in the bill that, you know, I think that can be done really easily and quickly. And I think you're going to see that in this first version, which is things like removing the mandated coverage requirements on the plan designs. I mean, that's not really been successful for anyone in the program since it came in. You've heard Trump talk a lot about, you know, the insurance state lines negotiations, that piece of it, you know, is an easy one. So there's some things that can be done quickly, and there's some things that can be that are going to take a little bit more time. But I think, you know, at the end of it, we didn't have a perfect healthcare system before the ACA. We didn't have a very good system with the ACA. We're probably not going to have a perfect healthcare system after the Trump bill passes. But the key is we can do better than what we're facing right now. And so I think that's probably going to be the outcome we're shooting for.
Well, you know, it's interesting your observations about what's going on in Washington and the legislation. It seems to me that there is a growing number of people, right or wrong, in this country who believe that they shouldn't have to pay anything for health care. And as I look at what happened related to the passage of Obamacare, setting aside the fact that the president misled the people 26 or 29 times about keeping plan and keeping doctor, I don't really believe, and there are some people who disagree with me that they don't think that the administration is as smart as I think they are. But this was all a ruse to get us to universal health care, to put the insurance companies out of business. And they knew that this was not going to work, but they needed to get to single payer, and they had to get the American people to be so despondent over the increasing premiums and the costs and everything else that they wanted the government to fix it. But I'm really concerned about this idea that seems to be floating, and I'd love to have your opinion on it, about this idea that health care is a right and they don't have to pay for it.
Well, I mean, health care, you know, I've worked overseas in foreign health care markets that have had nationalized health care, and, you know, it's a misconception for anyone to think that you're not paying for health care if you view it as a right or not a right, because, you know, if you live in the NHS, which is arguably the most successful of the government-funded health care programs, what you'll find is you're going to be your payment for your NHS premium and your NHS care just is withdrawn straight from your paycheck before you ever see it, just like Social Security or FICO is in Medicare here in the United States. And so the idea is that it's free and you're not going to pay for it is a misconception, because everyone pays for it. And in fact,
yeah,
if you look at the NHS, in many cases, you're paying more for that care. Their citizens are paying more for that care and receiving less benefit than we're paying with our higher premiums and our deductibles on our plans. And so it's not really, you know, an
free
idea that it's free. As a right, I could say that, you know, if you look at the waste we have in the healthcare system, if you look at the inefficiencies in the healthcare system, and if you look at the lack of free market forces in the healthcare system, I would argue that, you know, we do have a responsibility as society to take care of those who are unable to take care of themselves, you know, with health care. And if we were to streamline our system and make it more efficient, we could do that and pay a lot less than we're paying in the systems we're under today.
Well, you know, I've been involved with investments for 43 years and developed a lot of insurance products when I was working for major Wall Street firms. And I may have a wrong perception here, but this idea that we can sell insurance across state lines, I suspect, given that the accountability and the responsibility for insurance products is a state-level issue, not a federal, that there are going to be a lot of insurance commissioners across the fruited plain who are going to object to the central government telling them they have to let everybody into their state. And so we may wind up with a state's rights suit here over the replacement of Obamacare, trying to get across state lines to bring prices down. You may see the states push back. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, no, I think it's very possible. You know, I think if you look at the insurance industry as a whole, you'll find that in many states you'll have in a lot of states in the country, we have a predominant payer already, insurance company. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, they are so entrenched in those markets that even allowing competition state lines in those particular markets probably is not going to impact that insurer, that payer that much. However, we got some states where, like, for example, in the Northeast, where you're very, you know, you got a really tight geography with a lot of population, and you got different states where some competition might help here and there. It's, you know, it's something I think it can help in some states. In some states, I don't think it's going to make that much difference just because of the market forces that are already in place there. But yeah, you're going to have some commissioners here that I think that's possible. And in some places, it may just not be a big enough deal that it comes, you know, it bubbles up to the surface. But, you know, I don't think state lines is the answer to everything. I think it can help you in some markets, you know, and can help some consumers. But I think it, as we look at healthcare reform, it really should not be one piece or this piece. It needs to be a really comprehensive plan that looks at many, many things. And, you know, we've believed at the company where we are, you know, that if you can allow people choice and the ability to make informed market decisions, free market forces drive down costs more than any type of regulation or regulatory change or things of that nature. And so I think if we can get to that goal and to let people consume the products they need and at a rate they can, then we'll see natural competition bring things down more than regulated competition. That's my view, and that's what we've seen in the company where we operate in the markets we're in.
Well, speaking of your company, we want to find out about your company, what you do, and how you can help our small business people who are listening to the show. So I'm going to turn this over to Don.
Well, I guess, Paul, tell us about MD Save and just go from there.
You know, MDSA was a company that we started right after the ACA under the idea that when you looked at the mandated coverage changes and plans, that you'd have a lot of people on high deductible health plans, a lot of people paying out of pocket, and some uninsured. And so the idea behind MD Save was to negotiate directly with the healthcare system providers, the hospitals, the doctors that they own, and offer fully bundled procedures and episodes of care up front and have a dramatically reduced cost in exchange for paying up front. So essentially, we go to hospitals and tell them, if you'll give us a rate that's 40 to 60% better than what the insurance companies can access, we'll allow patients to shop, compare, and purchase online, just like on Expedia or Amazon.com. And when they make a purchase, we'll pay the provider in 6 days or less with no claims to file and guarantee zero bad debt. And then that way, the patient's able to just come on that website and see a particular healthcare procedure and see multiple providers that offer it, the cost at each one of them that's fully encompassed and fully loaded, and they can make their own choice on where they want to go and use their HSA dollars or pay cash, and then they can file it towards their insurance if they choose to. But the idea is just letting people, if you can make it easy for people to understand what they're buying, be able to make it actionable where they can shop and purchase it, American consumers will make good decisions. And small business people, a lot of us carry HSA plans. A lot of us are paying that out of pocket. And there's, you know, the fallacy in healthcare is that there's any correlation between cost and quality is a complete myth. And so it's really, you know, do your research and look around, but the data will show you repeatedly that there's no correlation between cost.
Paul, let me see if I understand this. I think it's a great idea. I have a policy, let's say, with Blue Shield Blue Cross of New Jersey, and it's a $5,000 deductible, and I have to have a spine operation. And I can look go on your site and see five or six hospitals here in New York or New Jersey, and they say, look, the total package, one hospital will be $4,000, one will be $4,100, $4,200, and then I can choose whichever one it is and pay that and somehow have it credited to my Blue Shield Blue Cross account. Did I understand that right?
That's right. So you could pick and choose where you wanted to go. You make that purchase, and you're paying that cash, and then it'll keep a record for you. And inside the account that you created, which there's no cost to create, you can go in and create a claim form and send it into your carrier if you want it to count, if that's important to you. And they'll count it towards the deductible. But you'll save – in the markets that we are operating in, there's about 30 states, 175 markets. We've lowered the average out-of-pocket cost by 40 to 60% in the last 3 years just by allowing people to have choice and the ability to choose and negotiate.
I have to follow up with, if I can, Don, I'd like to follow up on that because I'm either shocked or I don't totally understand what you're saying. So let me try and say it, then you tell me where I'm wrong. A consumer can go on to your website. By what is your website address?
It's just mdsave.com.
Okay, and we'll put that on our website at the end of the show. Go to mdsave.com, and you say, I need to have a thyroidectomy. And
that's correct.
And you'll go on, and you'll put in that you need to have a thyroidectomy, and you'll get a list of hospitals in your area that will provide that service in your program for a discounted price of X. Then the surgeon who's going to perform the procedure, he obviously has to have credentials at the hospital that you choose in order to be able to have the surgery. Correct.
Right. So what you'll see is it will offer online. You'll see, say it was Mount Sinai Hospital as an example. And what you're in that procedure, that thyroidectomy that you chose, it's going to include your initial physician consultation, the facility fee, the anesthesia fee. If there's pathology required, it's going to be included. If there's PT required, that's going to be included. So you're going to see the whole episode of care up front what the price is going to be among all the different providers. Now, it's going to include that surgeon who is part of that hospital in those. And now you can go, you can contact us and you can choose a particular surgeon. But it may be, you know, if you're looking and you're one guy and you want to go somewhere else, then you might have a different surgeon. But it's all those providers are going to be included, and they're all credentialed, licensed providers that are part of that particular healthcare system and have those privileges. All that part's been figured out for you.
And you've pre-negotiated a series of procedures at a all-in price at anywhere from 40 to 60% discount off of what they would normally pay. And let's say that the procedures all in is going to cost $10,000. Do I, as the consumer, pay 100% of the $10,000 up front?
You would. Now, we have 100% money-back guarantee. So for some reason, you if you went to the provider and found out, you know, maybe in your consultation that you needed something else and you didn't need that procedure, then we would just do a refund, or you can do a refund recredit. You can refund that and purchase the proper procedure with the provider's assistance if you needed that. And, yeah, you would pay it up front. Now, I would advise you on the surgery. In the surgery world, you know, if you have a, you know, a high deductible, for example, say you had a $2,500 deductible and you have a $10,000 procedure, this probably wouldn't make sense for you because you're going to end up paying, you know, $2,500 no matter what the cost is based on your deductible, right? But where it really comes into a play is maybe you got a $10,000 deductible and you need a $5,000 knee scope. Well, you're going to be paying 100% of that out of pocket with your health plan. So you could might be able to get a $5,000 knee scope with us for $3,000. You know, same provider, maybe even. The other place that makes sense is, you know, all those diagnostics we all have to have before we find out what we need. The MRIs, the CTs, the PETs are all well over $1,000. You know, you can save 50, 60% of those. Those make sense. And then, of course, if you're uninsured or if you're an employer and you have a self-insured plan, this is a rate where you're paying all the bills for your employees. This is a great option to lower those costs dramatically, you know, for those procedures.
Is there, on your website, is there a way for a consumer, and we're almost out of time, I apologize, a way for a consumer to figure out whether what you have to offer is the right thing for him or something else?
Yeah, well, if you come online, it gives a suggestive search. We also have a support center that they can call in and talk to. And then often, you know, consumers will find out that usually when you're buying a healthcare procedure, you've already seen maybe your general practitioner or some provider, and you know that you need this, which is why you're looking for it. You know, you've already been told that specifically. So often when you're buying something in healthcare, you know what you need. But, you know, the only time I would say that you have a hard time figuring it out is sometimes people might buy like an example like an MRI, and then when they get there, they might find out that, you know, the provider says, we can actually do this with an X-ray. In that case, we would just refund them and let them purchase an X-ray, you know, while they're there on the spot so that they don't have to pay that extra fee.
Anything else you want to add, Don?
Oh, yes, I have a question. It makes no difference whether the hospital and the surgeon are in-network or not, because you're generally paying less than the insurance company would have paid for it. And really, you're paying for it out of pocket, correct?
That's right. I mean, the only difference is, you know, the money, if you want it to count towards your deductible, it may count towards your in-network deductible if it's an in-network physician, or the out-of-network deductible if it's an out-of-network. But you're exactly right. I mean, the prices are, you know, they're 40 to 60% better than the in-network price. So you're going to do better off usually. And you know, there's no fee to use MDSave, like to log on and look at it. And so, you know, if you're got a question about it, I say always log on and take a look. It doesn't hurt to take a free look and know what you should be paying and talk to your doctor about it.
Oh, I have one more question, which is, you say you're in 30 states. What are the states that encourage that seem to encourage, and what are the states that don't? I mean, is there a general reason some states are more amenable to this? This sounds like a great gift to the American people, because what is it now? Almost 50% of all individual insurance policies are now at the $5,000 level or above, and that it's growing and amongst small businesses as well, that the cost. So what is the criteria that a state has it and some states don't?
You know, the majority of them, we're in the majority of states that have population of the bitch, and, you know, we're all down the East Coast, all across the Southeast. Where we're not, it's just some, you know, some of the states we haven't made market priorities for us. We're only a 4-year-old company. So getting to some of the states, like, for example, in the Great West, where you have very few medical facilities, you know, we're still working through those. And then, you know, there's a couple weird states where we just have some regulatory reasons that it doesn't make sense to operate in. So, for example, Maryland, no one is allowed to charge, you know, charge under a state set price. So you're not allowed to lower prices, even if you choose to. So we don't operate in that particular state. So there's a couple of those, but not many. You know, I mean, it's in most of the coast. Yeah.
So, Paul, it's been a terrific. You've helped us a lot and given us a lot to think about. We encourage our listeners to go to your website, and thank you for joining us. And perhaps as we get through this repeal and replace of Obamacare, we can have you back on. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And now a word from our sponsor. We'll be right back after this message.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
Welcome back to Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful. Now it's time for Money in Motion. Dan Perkins is our resident expert in making the money you earn work as hard as you do. Here is Dan Perkins.
Just a flash that came across my wire while we were on the air with our previous guest. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates 0.25%. And the stock market rallied about 100 points. I don't know where it is at the moment, but apparently it likes the number. I think what might have encouraged the market was the language that I saw after it attached to the rate increase. And they said that that they're going to kind of watch and see what happens. So they're going to be guarded about raising rates in the future. Not that they're not going to, and not that they still don't have a target of two more times, but recently there was a report by the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas which showed the overall economy slowing to a projected 1.2% GDP for 2017. But that was discussed at the board meeting, but and has some impact of what they're going to do. So employment will be an important factor, new jobs, and the Fed will watch very carefully what's going on. But I think the market was encouraged that the Fed is going to be cautious about making further rate increases.
I just can't believe that raising rates, I'm sorry, I just don't understand this, encourages economic growth. Can you explain that to me, Dan?
The reason why the Federal Reserve took interest rates down to zero and kept them there almost the entire time of the Obama presidency was because they felt that by lowering the rate of interest that people could earn to zero, it would force them to buy alternatives. For example, to get any kind of return, to take risk and put money in the stock market buying stocks. If you think about the logic, if I'm going to take less risk by buying an interest-bearing certificate of deposit or money market account, and it's virtually paid, we had money market funds, Don, that have paid almost nothing for 8 consecutive years, meaning people put money to work in a money market account purely for liquidity and for not only no return, actually negative return. Even in a low inflationary environment, if you earn nothing on your money, you're losing money and value to inflation. So the idea of lower interest rates, for example, the European Union has their official rate at zero. The idea is to try and change behavior by making any instrument that produces interest less attractive. And things that have the opportunity to pay dividends and to appreciate in value. And look what happened. Look what happened in the stock market during the Obama term. Look what happened after Trump was elected. Almost $3 trillion of wealth has been created since Trump won the election in the stock market. So the Federal Reserve is trying to say, okay, we've kept rates down for a long period of time, trying to stimulate growth. And now that, quote, growth is coming, and they measure growth in the fact that the unemployment rate is 4.6, full employment in the eyes of the Federal Reserve is 4.4. As we get closer and closer, we're only 20 basis points away from full employment. The Federal Reserve is now saying that the economy is recovering, and perhaps rapidly, to the point that we may see inflation. And so raising interest rates may tend to cool the unemployment factor and put more people to work. By raising rates, people will be looking to invest money, now continue to buy and invest in alternatives in order to try and make their portfolios grow. It is it's a number that's fraught with danger, because to say that we are at a 4.6 unemployment rate is a misnomer, because the actual unemployment rate is probably closer to 10. We have about 94 million people who are out of the employment market in the United States or underemployed. We got 44 million people on food stamps. So we have a lot of people. In fact, one in five households in this country have nobody working in them at all. One in five, 20% of the households have nobody working. And I don't understand why the Federal Reserve is not looking at those statistics, but they're not. And so as a result, they're focused in on the unemployment rate, which is a bogus number, and feel that they have to raise interest rates because they're afraid that the economy is going to overheat. Yet they've got the Dallas Federal Reserve Board issuing a report last week that they think that the economy is weakening, could be only up about 1.2% this year. So it is a convoluted mess, and it's hard to figure out. I mean, I look at what happened, and I can't understand why things are going the way they are.
Dan, and we have a taped interview with Mika Yamamoto that I've wanted to play for the last two shows. So my suggestion is the audience listen to this wonderful interview with Ms. Yamamoto, which she's with SAP, and I think it'll be very interesting.
Our next guest, I'm really looking forward to. She's Mika Yamamoto. She's Chief Marketing Officer of SAP, and she's here to discuss something that we hear a lot about, but I frankly am depending on her to explain a little bit more, digital transformation and what it means for small businesses. Mika, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, as we ask all our guests, before we do anything else, tell us a little bit about yourself, Mika, your background, et cetera, and how you got to where you are now.
Absolutely. You know, I'd say that my small business route started early. I was the child of a Japanese immigrant, and he was a small business. My dad was a small business owner. My mom was a small business owner. And so I watched my dad, do all of his books on his abacus as I was growing up. He'd close the books on his abacus, and then I watched him actually go through a journey of eventually buying a computer and eventually, taking some of his business online as I continued to progress and watch his business grow. And then, years later, I ended up going in and legitimately diving into the small business space by becoming a Gartner analyst. and covering the small and mid-sized business space, doing primary research for them on predicting trends in the market. Then went to Microsoft and did some product management and the Windows group for small and mid-sized businesses and some channel strategy for that market. Then went into the consumer space for a while, and then over to with Microsoft with Amazon, and then came over to SAP. And what's been great about the culmination of those experiences is that the consumer experience has been great to watch how we can, you know, drive scale among small and mid-sized businesses. But tying all that together is presents us with a great opportunity to be able to help small businesses today.
Well, you and IDC, SAP and IDC, have done a new survey, and it's about digital transformation. My first question, as I said, is what do you mean by digital transformation, and what did the survey tell you and can tell us?
Absolutely. So, you know, digital transformation essentially is the journey that companies of all sizes go through to take advantage of the technologies that are out there that are driving the hyper-connectivity and that are taking advantage of, mobility. And it's taking those technologies, whether it be software, whether it be hardware, taking advantage of those technologies to, better reach customers, to better serve customers, to better process or manufacture goods, and to overall, drive efficiencies and effectiveness in how companies run their businesses, especially small businesses, and then how they can make better business decisions because they're doing so. And so we engaged IDC last November in driving a study to truly understand how small and mid-sized businesses are thinking about technology. I mean, it's not like a digital transformation is a daily word that's used around the dinner table or even, in a lot of meetings among small and mid-sized businesses. But what is bantered about is, how do we take advantage of the technology out there today to be able to, improve how we can meet our customers' needs, improve how we can, run our businesses and make better business decisions. And so we went to launch a study among 3,900 small and mid-sized businesses in 13 countries across multiple industries to really understand and ask them about, what do they consider when they're making business decisions tied to technology. What inhibits them or slows them down or concerns them about using technology to be able to help them with their businesses, and really seeing where they were on the spectrum of considering, using technology to drive their business, which essentially is, digital transformation.
So tell us some of the results of this study.
I think that the most outstanding result is that that most of the companies, 50% of the companies were saying that marketing was their biggest potential in terms of leveraging technology to be able to drive their business. And so, and that's fed by the fact that most stated as number one is that customer acquisition was their number one goal or business priority for them, whether across multiple countries, across all the industry segments that we studied and across the enterprise size segments, customer acquisition was number one in terms of business priority, and therefore, marketing and marketing automation type tools from a technology standpoint, they saw was the biggest, they saw biggest potential in terms of taking advantage of those technologies.
Well, that's interesting. We're using technology today for smaller companies to get into business. Marketing. But aren't we also using it to do a lot of the functions and use that before we had to have one or two people on staff? Now we can do it almost automatically.
Yeah, we can do it automatically. Small businesses specifically can do it automatically, even if they didn't have those one or two people. So, examples are when you have a front-end solution that might involve e-commerce and might also involve, some light CRM tool and also marketing automation. A company actually could a small business company can actually know their customers, use data about their customers to inform how they buy in the future, what types of sales or promotions they might actually put on in a given time to be able to reduce their inventory in a specific area where they might be high in inventory, and then be able to see buying patterns among their customers where all that information before and data wasn't necessarily tied together for them, and so they didn't even have the one or two people to do that just because it was a complex set of items and processes that were necessary to take advantage of that information, so they never had it before. So it's both, you know, taking advantage of processes and tools to be able to use those, you know, be able to use people better, but also be able to do things that they never could do before.
Well, you're with SAP, and SAP I always think of as a big company tool. How is SAP involved, and what have you learned from the survey to apply to SAP?
You know, SAP is a really huge company, and we do, you know, we do serve, and we're most known for serving, you know, Fortune 500 companies. But 80% actually of the companies that we actually do business with and that we help in their digital transformation, help them take advantage of technology to be able to improve their business value and value to their customers, are actually small and mid-sized businesses. So 80% of SAP's customers are small and mid-sized businesses. And they're leveraging, you know, they're leveraging lots of different solutions that we have, whether it's time and expense management or analytics or helping them run their you know, supply chain. We help customers and small business companies, you know, in over 150 countries with small business solutions. And so this insight really helps us to be able to be very customer focused. I mean, as a small and mid-sized business-focused team, we're, you know, customer-obsessed. We want to understand, you know, what's motivating and driving the business decisions of these customers so to make sure that we're now and in the future able to meet those needs and ensure that, you know, every person that that works at a small business can see the most value out of the data that they have within their company. That the business can make the best business decisions possible, that the company, you know, can understand its customers. And most importantly here, we realize that, you know, marketing has the biggest potential from a technology standpoint because customer acquisition is really important. So that informs us in the type of data that and functionality that we build into our products now and in the future to make sure that, again, we're adding, you know, we're adding business value and helping customers run more simple, and again make better business decisions.
Okay, well let's go dive a little deeper into that. I'm a small business. I'm trying to sell widgets, or in the case of someone I interviewed yesterday, wedding gowns. What can my technology tell me that can help me do a better job?
Well, I mean, in terms of wedding gowns, I mean, there's, you know, and if we're talking about a wedding gown, you know, manufacturer and seller, there's multiple ways that you could find out great information to be able to help your business run better. If you're talking about, you know, front end from a customer standpoint, which is, you know, again, where most of the focus for small businesses is you can start to see information about how your customers are, using your website. You can get aggregate information about what types of search results people are actually searching on for wedding dresses. That information is now accessible to small businesses. And when you have a website, for example, where someone can enter their information, you can then have a point of contact, and you can have a conversation and start having a relationship with a bride, and help that bride with her journey in making a huge decision in her life. And then you can establish that relationship in a way that you at scale that you probably couldn't do before, just if you had a phone and a shop. physical brick and mortar shop, because you have the ability to reach customers that are, you know, far away. And I've known some brides who have looked, at the UK and sourced their wedding gowns in the UK online, and that extends the reach of the small business to be able to access more customers and have a relationship with more customers, just because they can get their digital information and connect with them. But then once the purchase is made, what they can do is they can take a look at all their purchases and see how they can and see what's actually being bought. Is it all the high-end dresses that are being purchased? Is it all the middle of the road dresses that are being purchased? What are people looking at, but what are people buying? And they can compare and contrast that to be able to both design their website. So if some people are looking at the really high-end dresses, but really buying the middle of the road dresses, they can actually buy less fabric for the high-end dresses, buy more fabric for the middle of the road dresses, if in fact that's the place they want to be. Or they can think about how they might position their high-end dresses differently and do some testing on if they position it differently on the website, does it sell more high-end dresses? And that type of testing, is possible now to a small business, whereas, in the past it was really complicated. It was really hard to be able to manipulate your website experience. It was really challenging to extract and connect all the data that you would get about your customers. And so you're using your gut as a small business owner and some of the data and cobbling it together, but now those insights are more readily available.
Well, I threw you a curve saying the wedding dress, but you did a wonderful job of explaining it. By the way, I have someone listening in, and they sent me an email across my desk and said, what is an abacus?
Oh, what's an abacus? So it's a – did you answer it? Are you going to – you answered online or –
Well, no. I'm going to – our audience will like to know as well, if you know. I mean, I can describe it as an ancient Chinese method of doing complicated mathematical and record keeping. But perhaps you know a better answer. It's an old tool, but it's amazing. I'm a lot older than a lot of people, and sometimes when I teach a class and I mention something, my class, the students look at me with a blank face, and I realize they don't really know what I'm talking about. In this case, an abacus is something we don't see in much anymore.
We really don't. My dad still uses one, actually. He's actually done a pretty massive digital transformation, but he still falls back on his abacus every so often. And so an abacus is essentially, before we had computers and electricity, it's essentially, a calculator. It's a calculator that was used in Europe and in China, Japan, Russia, back in the day when, again, there wasn't electricity, there weren't calculators, but it was a means of calculating and tabulating with beads that essentially sit on wires, and if you slide them up or down, is essentially the position of the bead on the wire within the rows actually, is an indicator of what the result is that you're calculating.
We're talking with Mika Yamamoto. She's with SAS. She's Chief Marketing Officer of SAP, and we're really glad to have her today. Before we go, Mika, if I may call you that, what are some of the other results of the survey that you'd like to pass on to our audience?
I think that what's amazing to, I think that what was really surprising to us was, it was great to see the focus on the customer. What was actually encouraging for us to see also is when we were asking small businesses who had adopted some technology to start transforming their businesses, they were actually pleasantly surprised to see that it actually wasn't as challenging as they thought it was going to be. And so I think that there's a notion that a lot of the solutions out there to, either drive your website, drive marketing automation, or run your back end from a supply chain standpoint are complex. I mean, we run into that as SAP, but the that really the, you know, the solutions that are out there now are actually designed for small businesses in mind. And so, you know, small businesses are realizing that the use of these, this technology is actually easier, and that they were able to realize the value that, that was promised to them in a much simpler way than they previously thought. And so I think that that was, that's, I mean, it's nice to see. I think technology has definitely come a long way where functionality has been simplified. The ability, you know, to be able to leverage solutions in the cloud means you don't need a lot of infrastructure. You don't need a lot of people, you know, in your environment or in your company to have to do a lot on the back end from a technology standpoint. You just need to understand your business. And because a lot of these solutions are more affordable, because they're a lot more simple, they're more accessible to small businesses now more than ever. And it's just really encouraging to see that small businesses are realizing that and giving feedback to say, hey, you know, I thought it was going to be a lot more complicated, but it's not.
Well, did you ask them about the money question, about how, whether doing a digital transformation, what were some of the decision criteria, particularly in terms of money?
You know, we didn't specifically ask about money. In terms of, you know, if you had a, you know, so we didn't specifically ask, you know, percentage of funding allocation to areas. What we did ask, though, is, you know, what were they considering or concerns or benefits that they were considering when they're thinking of investing in the cloud specifically, for example. You know, and I think this ties to money is that, you know, as they talk about things that they, you know, things that are driving cloud use of, you know, of applications is the fact that now they have the ability to integrate their current applications, their current environment into new functionality, whereas that wasn't possible before. And, you know, also tied to efficiency and money is now they feel like they can expand their resources so they can do more with the people that they have, whether they're IT people or whether they're salespeople, marketing people, or shop floor people, that they can actually do more with those individuals by leveraging technology. That they can add new functionality, add new users in a lot more simple way. So things have become, they can run a lot more efficiently. They can, you know, see more growth with their customers, and they can do so in a way that wasn't accessible to them before.
We're talking with Mika Yamamoto. She's Chief Marketing Officer of SAP. And people want to learn more about the survey, about you, about SAP. How do they do it?
Well, they can, you know, there's our website, that sap.com. They can go into our small business area and look at what solutions we have. They're more than welcome to actually reach out to me personally. You know, mika.yamamoto@sap.com. I'd be happy to answer any questions or talk about SAP to any small business out there.
Will you spell out your last name? I can spell it, but maybe
no
our
problem.
Audience doesn't.
No problem. It's so mika.yamamoto@sap.com.
Okay. Mika, thank you so much for joining us today. I know I've learned a lot, and I hope our audience has as well. Thank you.
Don, thank you so much.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. It's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
My name is Dan Perkins, and I'm your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a program dedicated to helping small business leaders increase profits. We draw our names from the best-selling book, which features the contributions made by more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all of whom offer ways to grow your small business.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here because I think we're going to have a lot of fun doing this program. But the only constant in business is change. For small business leaders, it means taking the time to better understand what is happening to their companies, employees, and clients. Every show, Dan Perkins and I and our guests will talk about what's happening in today's world.
Okay, let's talk about money. Money in motion. See, the only way that you as a small business person can make money is you at work and your money at work. And for many small business people, they're spending so much time at work trying to build and grow their businesses, they have very little time to really manage the money and the profits potentially that the business gives them. So understanding that trying to get the most out of your money, having it work as hard as you do, is an important part of being a successful business person. If you don't know what you're doing, or as the old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. You need, as much as you need a plan for your small business, you also need a plan for your money. Now, money means more than just putting money in investment. Money means, how am I going to fund my company? How am I going to get the money to grow? Most small businesses, in fact, the America is made up of more small businesses and more small businesses who employ 50 people or less than any other form of employment in the United States. Most small businesses start up by either using their equity in their home or a credit card debt. But that's a tough one, because when you take a loan out for home equity or you take money out of your credit card, the banks are funny. They want to get paid back. And that means you've got to make a monthly payment. And so understanding what is the most appropriate payment for finding the credit to build your business is very important. You can borrow money from the Small Business Administration. It's not an easy task, but not impossible. For a small businessman, especially a startup, just learning about business, working with the SBA can be extremely daunting and very frustrating. Credit cards, on the other hand, make money easily available, but they pay a very high interest rate. So I like to tell people, if you're going to build a business, if you're going to start a business, you need to have some kind of money in the bank, because the principal reason that businesses fail is not because they don't have a good business idea, is they don't have enough money to capitalize the business to take it through the growing stages where it can become successful.
So, you know, Dan, you talked about a lot, but for instance, in today's news, it's everybody's talking about an increase in the interest rate. What does that really mean to small businesses?
Well, that's a good question, Don. The Federal Reserve has only raised interest rates twice in the last 10 years, trying to support the economy and providing liquidity for people to borrow money to refinance their houses or whatever. Given the momentum that seems to be building in the economy, the Federal Reserve has indicated that they want to raise interest rates probably three times this year, and they'll probably move it 0.25% at a time. So if they raise interest rates 0.25% three times in the next 12 months, that means the short-term interest rates will be up 0.75%, which means that short-term interest rates will probably be in the neighborhood of about 1.5%. Now, the prime rate will go up every time the Fed raises rates. So if the prime rate today, for example, is 3.5%, if the Fed goes up 0.75%, then the prime rate's going to be about 4.25%. Prime rate is a basis by which the banks use to price money that they give to individuals for various purposes. And depending upon the credit risk of the person or the institution, there is what is called a risk premium over the riskless rate of return. So if the treasury, short treasury, is at 4.25, prime is at 4.25, then if you're a startup business, you're not going to be a great credit. There's going to be a significant amount of failure risk in loaning money to you. So I would guess that they're going to want at least 100% premium to borrow money.
We're going to come back to this topic time and again over the next months here on this program. On every show, Dan Perkins and I and our guests will talk about what's happening in today's world.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.